Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. E-waste. Do you know what becomes of the computer, printer, or cell phone you diligently carried to an electronic recycler? Well, most of the news isn't good. These devices, with their incredibly short obsolescence, are filled with precious and rare natural resources and deadly toxins. Developing nations wanting to get their hands on them, both for the precious metals and for the fees paid for recycling them. The story of who and how they are allegedly recycled isn't pretty. Neither is the story about where these precious resources are found and the damage extracting them causes to the creatures and the planet. The story was very well reported by 60 Minutes several weeks ago and can be viewed on the website for the Basel, B-A-S-E-L, Action Network, which is www.ban.org. And today we're joined by somebody from BAM, Sarah Westervelt. She is the E-Stewardship Director from BAM. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. A single nucleotide polymorphism is a variation in the sequence of molecules that make up DNA. Polymorphism refers to the possibility that different molecules can take a specific position in a large molecule, such as a strand of DNA. Nucleotide refers to the four molecules that make up DNA strands, and single refers to a difference in just one place on the DNA strand that can have significant biological and health effects. As you know, the sequence of nucleotides in a strand of DNA is what holds the information from which biologically active molecules such as enzymes and proteins are made. Polymorphism in the DNA leads to polymorphisms in the one or more enzymes or proteins produced from the DNA sequence. The enzyme or protein polymorphism coming from different sequences of amino acids, the molecules that make up enzymes and proteins. A change in one amino acid can lead to a change in how well an enzyme or protein works. In the most recent issue of the journal Leukemia and Lymphoma, Chinese researchers examined one such single nucleotide polymorphism and its effect on the risk of leukemia in children exposed to weak electromagnetic fields from electric power lines and transformers. Children who had a specific variation of this polymorphism, a SNP for short, were almost four times as likely as children with the more common SNP to suffer from acute leukemia. Critics of the extensive research showing the relationship between childhood leukemia and power lines and other sources of weak EMF exposures claim that the energy is too weak to cause the DNA damage that results in cancer. What this latest research suggests is that EMF exposure doesn't break DNA directly. Instead, it disrupts the enzymes responsible for repairing DNA breaks caused by other exposures. What I just said has two parts. All manner of things happen to us all the time that cause breaks in the necklace of nucleotides that make up our DNA. These can be ionizing radiation from ultraviolet light, CT scans, dental X-rays, and, of course, atomic bombs. Breaks can also happen as a result of toxic exposures, for example, from the chemicals in tobacco smoke. But we have genes that produce enzymes that patch up these breaks. The Chinese researchers were looking at one of the SNPs in one of the genes responsible for DNA repair enzymes. They looked at that SNP because previous research found it associated with both breast and prostate cancer. So that's part one. Part two is that what put children at risk wasn't a variation in a nucleotide sequence. What put them at risk were exposures that broke their DNA and thwarted their little body's natural capacity to protect itself. The point of this research is not that you should have your children tested for this particular SNP. The point is to minimize their exposure in the first place. Less radiation, both ionizing and EMF, which includes both first-hand and second-hand exposures from cell phones, wireless routers, BlackBerries, and all other marvels of the digital age, and less chemical exposure, such as tobacco smoke, volatile organic chemicals, and pesticides. DNA has the capacity to repair itself. It's part of our body's capacity to heal. It's part of our children's body's capacity to heal. It's quite amazing. We should honor our biology and stop creating burdens that an increasing number of children cannot bear. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett, PhD, is an environmental economist, political economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me. Now to today's topic, electronics recycling scam. Our guest is Sarah Westervelt, spelled like it sounds, Westervelt. She is the e-stewardship director at the Basel Action Network, or BAN, BAN, and the reuse recycling chairperson for the Electronics Take Back Coalition. Her work includes administrating the e-stewards program, developing the e-steward certification program, educating the public about issues associated with exporting e-waste, as well as highlighting the worst-case scenarios. Sarah co-authored BAN exposés, including films and reports documenting horrific recycling in China and Nigeria. Through programs, policy, and education, the e-waste project provides guidance to go beyond inadequate regulations and practices and better understand existing international laws that pertain to trade in toxic wastes. Sarah has a master's degree in organizational systems renewal from Antioch University and has worked for years as a consultant in organizational development before joining the Basel Action Network in 2001. Welcome, before I start getting carried away, welcome to you, Sarah. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Before we get to whether these highly disposable products can be recycled, I want to cover the cost to the planet from their production, because I think even before we start talking about the fact that it might be possible to recycle them in a reasonably responsible way, I think we have to talk about whether the production of these products is responsible to begin with.
You're absolutely right that the production of electronic devices are highly problematic, and that's true for a number of reasons. And one of them is simply that they are relying on many, many resources from the Earth, including some that are buried deeply in the earth and have to be brought up to the surface. And so I'm talking about some of the heavy metals and things like mercury and toxins that are usually safely sequestered deep in the earth, and we bring them to the surface, we put them in our products, and then we use them for, 6 months, a year and a half, and then we throw them away, which of course is on the surface of the earth, and then we distribute those toxins all around the surface of the earth. And many of these heavy metals and rare earth metals are immortal, and so they last forever. So the production process requires bringing up and mining things that are much better left deep in the earth. It also requires a huge amount of energy and water. And in the process of creating these electronic devices, there are a lot of toxic processes that are used as well. For example, the creation of PVC, the polyvinyl chloride, that covers all the cabling that we have inside and outside of our electronics. That PVC typically is used mercury, uses mercury to create it. And so you've got a lot of toxic processes that involve a lot of worker exposure. And now, since much of that production of new equipment is occurring in China and other developing countries, these are many times countries that don't have good laws in place or enforcement of those laws, and so there's a tremendous amount of exposure. And I just learned from local designers here in Seattle, where we're based, that there are surfaces on the outside of, say, a little cell phone or a PDA that are desirable. The manufacturers want a really nice touch to the surface, but to get that surface, you have to treat it with a chemical that's banned in the United States. And so now it's happening in China where the chemical is not banned. So you're having a tremendous amount of worker exposure. And then, of course, if the facility, say in China or some other developing country, is just dumping a lot of the effluent either into the air or the water or the soil, there's a lot of exposure issues for the surrounding community and the rivers that flow into the oceans, which, of course, the whole planet shares. So we've actually been told that the production of this waste or this product stream is even far worse than the recycling impacts, which is pretty mind-boggling to comprehend.
That's where I went when I read the materials that you sent me along with the Greenpeace paper, Greenpeace briefing, Toxic Tech, the Dangerous Chemicals in Electronic Products. I assume this is downloadable on the Greenpeace website, I think, I hope.
Yes, I think it is.
Yeah.
They've got a good report.
Greenpeace
section.
Briefing, Toxic Tech, the Dangerous Chemicals in Electronic Products. It's 21 pages, so... These are names of things I've never even heard of that are, I mean, there are things you know about, like cadmium and lead and mercury and, I mean, just bromated fire retardants, you know, some of the stuff people have heard of, phthalates, you know, the plastics again, there we are with the plastics again, and then there are some things you've never heard of. And there's also the story of a coltan, which is destroying the gorilla habitat and... Also, as far as I can tell from listening to Democracy Now, in fact, that the workers are enslaved, the people who are working with the material.
It is really so important for, I think, everyone to understand that we are, at least in most developed countries, and I'm going to try not to speak from a U.S.-centric perspective, but because this electronic waste problem is really a global problem. As you can imagine, every developed country is deeply involved in electronics, and, of course, many of the developing countries are as well. So we have a situation where the manufacturers of these products are trying to obtain materials, say, out of the Congo or various places where there are horrific human rights violations happening. And there are these production problems where there's lots of worker exposure issues. And yet it's an industry that is very accustomed to being quite secretive because it's such a competitive industry. If you think of Dell and Hewlett-Packard, they're so neck and neck trying to be the number one seller in the world for laptops or computers. And there's a very high level of secrecy, and they're not accustomed to being transparent about the manufacturing process and who their suppliers are, or now that they're being forced to take back their products, for example, in Europe, they don't even necessarily want to be transparent about the downstream recycling of all of these products because they consider that proprietary information. It's interesting to note that in Europe, there is a culture that corporations should be in service to society and therefore much more transparent than what we expect from corporations here in the U.S. So there is a greater level of transparency there, and there's a movement now to try to daylight the entire life cycle of products that are created by a corporation. And I think that's the direction we need to move in. And as consumers, we can all demand that of our manufacturers. So if you buy products from company A, communicate with them and let them know that you would like to have very visible information on their website.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, production and well.
No, really, good luck with it, because there was an article, if I may interrupt you for just a moment, because this is very pertinent to what you're saying. This is so absent from what's going on. I mean, this business of... products being introduced and technologies being introduced with absolutely no accountability whatsoever at all, even after this whole thing of as you put it, daylighting the cigarette industry, this is still going on, and asbestos and all. And these products are not expandable. You know, they can't be upgraded so that they can be reused. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and say this on the air. I mean, let them call me. I bought a printer from Brother. It's a... It's a laser, a mono laser printer with toner. And I've used their products before. I like it because it works better with my Macintosh and whatnot. And I noticed that the toner is plastic and it heats up, so there's usually a smell that disappears after a while. This smell not only never disappeared, but it was the worst smelling printer I've ever had in my life. And I called it during the warranty period. We have two of them. And this was also right after a report came out in the newspaper, in the Associated Press, about the level of toxins in toner and how much it aerates into the room and how much it causes asthma and all kinds of problems in office environments. It's very toxic. And it listed the products that were lower, and of course you couldn't find them anywhere, the ones that are better. So I called Brother and I explained the problem, and I spent, I don't know, easily an hour and a half on the phone twice with them. They handed me around to various people. I finally got a supervisor. Initially, he listened, and then he handed me back to the representative who said, yes, we'll send you a new printer. Then the representative got a phone call from the other guy while he was on the phone. He said, no, we're not going to send you a new printer. And I've called since, and I still can't get through with them. I have to actually open all the windows in my offices every time I print it. I just can't. What am I going to do now with this thing? Am I going to throw it in the garbage? And as we're going to talk about, just try to recycle this stuff. Just go ahead and try. But I think you do have some good news on the recycling end. But the accountability issue, I really hope this new administration takes this on, because the technology is overrunning everything and they have the most power that I can imagine. I mean, it's the Telecommunications Act protects them. Everybody, gets protected except the citizens.
And you're absolutely right. And this is the way things have been for a long, long time in this country. And we do hope that with Obama at the helm, we'll start to see some shifting in that culture. It takes time. And I look for signs of hope, because there are some, and otherwise things get pretty discouraging. But what's happening in Europe is that they've actually created laws that are requiring all sorts of good things. And some of those laws were actually caused by grassroots movements, and I'd like to tell you about one of them, because I really do believe that if 300 consumers call Brother in the same month or two complaining about the same problem, Brother is going to listen, perhaps, if they know what's in their best business interest, and start to make some changes. In Europe, consumers were getting really frustrated with over-packaging. You go in to buy a little cartridge, and it's wrapped inside the bubble packaging that you can't even open, and that's inside something else. And you, in Europe, they were complaining and trying to get the manufacturers to change, and it was not happening. So what happened was a grassroots movement whereby consumers would go into the retail store, buy a new product, open it up right there at the counter, and leave all the packaging on the counter, and then walk out with their new product.
Along with some other packaging from the same store that they've saved up and dumped that on the counter, too.
And what happened was that the retailers, of course, started pulling their hair out and demanding that the manufacturers and the lawmakers deal with this problem, because it became very widespread. And that was the birth of the entire concept of producer responsibility, that the manufacturers of products have responsibility not only for the packaging, but for redesigning their products so that they don't have toxins in them, including the toner that you're experiencing, and all sorts of things. So there's absolutely a very strong movement in this direction in Europe, and they're passing laws that require it. Of course, we live in a country where the culture is that we don't require corporations to do those sorts of things if it looks like on the surface it could cause a loss of profits. I think we all know, especially with the concept of green jobs now widely shared, that when a government passes a law saying you must make non-toxic products with minimal packaging, that it creates a new level playing field. And then all of the manufacturers put their best innovation and research and development forward and meet this new kind of baseline requirement that they all create cleaner products. So things are headed in the right direction, and
yeah,
you're absolutely right. It is currently still a mess.
Well, and unfortunately, progressives are some of the biggest consumers of electronic products and new cell phones. And, I'll run into somebody that I know through the radio show, and they're using the newest iPhone, which is the most toxic. I mean, aside from the manufacturer of it, which Apple may have controlled to some degree, the amount of electromagnetic fields of that device exceeds allowable limits of what's healthy for. I mean, it's something like 900 milligausses every time you download an email you're getting exposed to, just in terms of electromagnetic, never mind the radio frequency. And it's this slick thing. And people say, and I go, oh, you're using one of those. And they say, oh, yeah, it'll probably kill me, you know, but they laugh. And I think, well, no, really, why are you laughing? Why are you using this? I mean, you know, do you also eat at McDonald's? I mean, it's so interesting that this whole, I'm going on a tantrum here. I'm sorry. I'll try to gear this back to what we started with. But, you know, this whole sort of excuse for closing the digital divide, which is what I'm afraid Obama also, you know, sits and uses a BlackBerry all the time. So never mind his cigarette smoking. I think the cancer rate from the BlackBerry is also for us to be concerned with. But the point is that not only are these created, not only are they extracting precious metals and then causing people who do the extraction and the manufacturing of these products to become terribly ill, it destroys habitat for the animals. Then we have this product that lasts, you know, 10 minutes, and then it goes, da-da-da-da, mostly back to China.
Right.
Mostly back to China. You go to these responsible recyclers. That's what we saw in the 60-minute program. You will, at the end of the show, I think, give us some, of course, they can always go to the website, ban.org, for this information, but there are more responsible recyclers. But practically speaking, how can this, I mean, well, let's go ahead and say what, let's talk about what, all, in case people didn't see or don't know, what is going on in China? Who are these poor farmers who can't make a living? What are they doing?
Well, if I could first tell you what's going on here to explain why our electronic waste is ending up in China, that might help kind of people understand the sequence of events.
Certainly.
We purchase brand new products because the manufacturers are very intentionally designing them so that we have to upgrade so often. Our software doesn't work on our hardware, et cetera. I mean, everybody knows the problems of, you know, downloading a new program and realizing that your hardware is not able to keep up with it. And of course, many people want the latest and the greatest technology. So the average lifespan here in the United States for a desktop or a laptop is about 18 months. And then we want to get rid of it and buy another one. And so if you can imagine the volumes of waste that are being created by this hazardous waste stream, it's absolutely mind-boggling. And if you walk into these recyclers' warehouses that are 100,000 square feet, and it's nothing but old monitors and TVs and CDs.
And, yeah, televisions, too.
Yes, the televisions.
Because now we have these new televisions everybody has to buy.
Right. The digital switchover is February 17th, and so a lot of people are having to get rid of their old analog TVs to prepare for not being able to receive the new digital signal in 09. But we've got a problem where there's just plenty of working equipment, but nobody wants it anymore. And so it's ending up at these recyclers' facilities. And they're faced with a very difficult problem. One is that these products, and I'm going to start to call them wastes now because nobody wants them anymore, are full of mixed materials. They're not like an aluminum can that has just aluminum in it, and it's very easy to recycle that single material. These have maybe 5 to 10 different types of plastics, many, many different kinds of metals, a lot of different both toxic and non-toxic materials, all mixed together, screwed together, bolted together, melted together, snapped together, and there's not enough value in those products to actually pay for responsible recycling. And so if someone doesn't pay the recycler to handle it responsibly, then it's very likely to go offshore. And the reason for that is because there's a lot, of course, lower wages and much lower protections in the developing countries. And countries like China, who are doing so much manufacturing for the world, need the copper and the aluminum and the steel. They don't need our hazardous waste, which they then have to smelt or further process. They need the clean commodities. But what they're doing now is buying our hazardous waste in the form of this electronic waste stream and essentially mining it for the things that they need, frequently using very toxic processes.
Very primitive.
Yes, very primitive. In a sense, using 17th century technology for 21st century problems. And one example of that is I mentioned earlier that the wiring in most of these devices has PVC on the outer sheathing. There's copper in the inside, and that's what they're after, the copper. So they burn the wire in open-air fires, burning off the PVC, and when that happens, you create some of the most toxic substances known, and this is true for many of the plastics in electronic waste that have the brominated flame retardants in them. You're creating dioxins and furans, and they are invisible, they're tasteless and odorless, so you can't even tell that they're there, and they're absolutely some of the most toxic substances ever created by humans. So what we're doing in this country is we're buying and throwing away these devices at an incredibly fast rate. And in addition to that, we are the only developed country. The United States is the only developed country that has not ratified a United Nations treaty called the Basel Convention. It was a UN treaty created in Basel, Switzerland back in 1989 to try to stop some really horrific dumping scandals that were happening. Italy, for example, was sending boatloads of hazardous waste to Nigeria and absolutely paying a landowner there $100 a month to take this stuff, and he was dead a year later. And many of these scandals happened, and there was a big outcry. The United Nations brought countries together, and they created this literally a trade barrier. So this Basel Convention, this international treaty, is designed to be a trade barrier for hazardous waste. And every developed country, and most of the developing countries in the world, have ratified this treaty. 170 countries have ratified it, and we're the only developed country that hasn't. We're in the same category with Haiti and Afghanistan as being the three countries that have signed it but haven't ratified it. So what that means is that if you're a recycler in this country and you take in all this, the old cell phones and computers and laptops and printers, you are faced with a very tough choice, and one is to try to convince your customers that they need to pay you to handle it in the developed world, or the other option is to sell it and sell it to brokers who are going to ship it off to China or to India or Pakistan or many, many other countries. And so they have the choice between spending money to do it right or making money by doing it wrong. And so we have this very uncontrolled waste stream here in the U.S., and there's so much economic incentive to do the wrong thing that that's, of course, exactly what's happening. But what's interesting to know is that China is among the many nations that have ratified this United Nations treaty, and therefore it's illegal for them to accept this material from the United States.
Doesn't seem to be stopping them, though, not according to what we saw in the 60 Minutes.
Right. It's absolutely not stopping.
Or I might mention this wonderful article that you pointed me to, AudubonMagazine.org, June 08 of this year. Ellen Ruppel Schell, Ellen Ruppel Schell, Shell, wrote an article called Trashed, and she explains exactly what Sarah has just told us in detail, including the fact that the water supply for these villagers who used to be able to farm and can't make money farming anymore is now destroyed by the toxins, and that children are handling these waste materials as well. So,
yeah, it's
overwhelming.
It is, and one of the reasons why there aren't controls in place in China is I think this country learned after the September 11th tragedy that it's very difficult for any country to control its imports. If you try to open up every single container that comes into every single port, you basically shut down commerce or slow it down tremendously. And so that's precisely why the Basel Convention, this UN treaty, called on the exporting countries to put the controls in place. You can set up your domestic laws to make such and such illegal. You have your enforcement mechanisms in place. You do spot checks for exporting activities. Because the United States hasn't ratified this treaty, we have no export controls in place. And so what we're doing is saying, here, we'll sell you our hazardous waste. We're happy to get it offshore and protect our citizens. We're making money in the process, and we don't have to deal with the exposures to the toxins from our waste. And instead, what the Basel Convention calls for is that every nation first and foremost, try not to create hazardous waste to begin with. That's the ultimate goal. So we really all do need to put pressure on the manufacturers to phase out the toxins. And the second thing it calls for is, if you do create hazardous waste, be self-sufficient in managing it, with the assumption that if we have to deal with our own toxic waste, we're going to be motivated to produce less of it. And then the third thing is, if you have to export it because you don't have facilities, then it needs to be done in compliance with this treaty. And of course, the United States isn't really doing any of those things. So we're absolutely, once again, the laggard, the worst player globally around exports of hazardous waste, because we have no controls in place around much of it.
Yeah. We need to break for a brief musical moment here. We're going to return with this very important interview with Sarah Westervelt from BAN.org concerning e-waste. So please stay with us. We'll be right back after this.
When I heard the news, my heart fell on the floor. I was on a plane on my way to Baltimore. In these troubled times, it's hard enough as it is. My soul has known a better life than this. I wondered how so many could be in so much pain, while others don't seem to feel a thing. And I cursed my whiteness, and I get so damn depressed. In a world of suffering, why should I be so blessed?
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and we're on the phone today with Ellen. I'm sorry, whoops. about to credit the article writer, Sarah Westervelt from Basal Action Network, BAN.org. Just a reminder, if you missed anything here today, there's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. And our information number is 707-874-2772. And please do visit the Basal Action Network at ban.org. Where you will find anything that we may have missed here, including very specific instructions about what to do about your own e-waste as it comes along. Jeff, did you have anything to add before we move to... Okay, let's contrast what we're doing here in the United States and what's going on in China with what some of the European countries are attempting to do that are at least moving in the direction of safer. As we have said in the beginning half of the show, the only safe thing to do is to produce these products safely without toxic materials. And that's the most important thing to start with. And then short of that, what's going on in Switzerland?
Well, in Europe, and of course this now is 27 nations that are part of the European Union, so it's a large number of countries. They've passed a what they call a directive, an EU directive, which means it has to go into the law in each of those 27 countries, in all of them. They passed a directive back in July of 06, I mean, went into effect in July of 06, that requires every manufacturer who wants to sell to European customers to take back their electronic and electrical products free of charge and conveniently. So any manufacturer who makes anything with a battery or a plug has to take them back free of charge in a way that you don't have to drive 100 miles to get rid of it for free. And at the same time, they passed another directive that's now in law in all the countries, which required the complete removal or phase out of six of the most prevalent toxins like lead, mercury, cadmium, hexavalent chromium, and a couple of the brominated flame retardants, and by the same date. And they essentially said by this date in 06, none of your products on the retail shelves must have these toxins in them. They did allow for some exceptions. And so those two directives have absolutely revolutionized the industry, because probably 2 or 3 years prior to that, they were saying, whoa, we don't have anything to do with the end of life of our products. We just design them and manufacture them. You know, we don't have anything to do with recycling. And Europe understood that if, and there's a wonderful institute in Sweden who actually figured out this concept, which they call extended producer responsibility. They looked at the entire life cycle of a toxic product. So we're talking about all the mining that you were referring to, and the manufacturing, distribution, and users using the products, and then recycling and hopefully reclaiming material and putting it back into more manufacturing. They looked at that life cycle of an electronic product and said, where is the most effective leverage point in that life cycle to actually solve the hazardous waste problem? It's certainly not at the recycler's facility, where truckloads are backing up and unloading literally thousands of TVs and computers, and they don't even know what toxins are in them, much less how to protect their workers, much less how to solve the problem so it doesn't continue. And of course, the answer was that the manufacturing phase is always the most effective point in that life cycle in which to solve the hazardous waste problem. So they essentially put forth this whole law in Europe asking the manufacturers to be responsible for the end-of-life costs, with the assumption that if Dell or Hewlett-Packard has to integrate the end-of-life or the recycling costs into the price of a brand-new product, that there's going to be enough pressure on them to continually lower their retail prices, that they would try to lower the cost of managing it and therefore get the toxins out. So this has had a very huge impact on the industry. What's, of course, been happening is that here in the U.S., those same manufacturers who are providing free take-back services in Europe have not been doing that for their customers in the U.S. And, of course, they could sell products that still have the toxins in them that are disallowed in Europe. And so what the environmental community has been doing here in the U.S. for the last maybe three, four years is sitting hard on the manufacturers, trying to shame them into offering the same services here that they do in Europe, so that there's not a double standard. And that has been happening to a very large degree. The Electronics Take-Back Coalition, which our group is a part of, has been very effective in getting Sony and Samsung and LG and Dell and Hewlett-Packard to provide free take-back programs. Our challenge now is to get these manufacturers to be fully transparent about what they're doing with it, because if they take back their products
and send them to China,
what we're doing, once again, is benefiting and protecting our citizens at the expense of poor communities in developing countries. And it is absolutely the wrong thing to do. It would be better, I hate to say this because it's not just a choice between A and B, but it would be better for these toxic materials to go in our carefully lined and monitored landfills than to be burned in open fires in India. So,
yeah, but I would posit that these, I mean, I'm sitting here looking at my printer right now, which looks very benign here in my office. It's here looking very benign, but I know that every time it heats up, it's spewing toxins into my environment. So another thing that I think people have to understand is that all these very useful technologies, which I, and I'm not a Luddite, I love my computer, you know, I love my technologies, I'm a radio show host, you know, broadcasting remotely, so please imagine that. But these materials, the thing that I think is important to explain here is that in many instances, people in Europe have devised ways to produce plastics and other materials that are free of these brominated flame retardants and these phthalates and these plastics that heat up and belch into your environment. So there are safer alternatives. But nobody is going to change anything, because if you change anything, you have to retool and you have to do all this, and so it costs money, and then they don't make more money than any other living human being on the planet, along with a few other industries. But there are better alternatives, I understand.
There are some safer alternatives for the toxic chemicals, and unfortunately, I think so far there's only safer alternatives for about, I think the figure is about 25% of all the toxins used in electronics, where safer alternatives have been defined. And one of the challenges is not only creating more safer alternatives, but defining what a safer alternative looks like, because it's not going to be acceptable to just substitute one toxin for another. And so that's a very important piece. And one of the things the environmental community is helping with right now is to really define, what safer alternatives look like and must, the properties that they must have. There's another really important initiative that's happening in Europe right now, and they call it the REACH initiative, which has to do with evaluation and assessment of chemicals, but it they're actually have identified something like 30,000 chemicals that are problematic, and they're requiring a process of evaluating them to prove that they're safe. So unlike this country, where companies get to put out toxins and they don't get pulled off the market until, whatever, 10 years after some people have died or, you know, been maimed for life, there's going to be a whole new approach in Europe, the precautionary principle, essentially, that the producers of potentially toxic materials must prove that they're safe before they can ever go to market. And this is really a fundamental shift that I'm hoping will spread to the U.S. And the one reason why I have hope that it may is not because our culture here would be to create legislation, but rather many of these companies are now saying they want to have one policy globally. And so if they're being forced to do this in Europe, hopefully they'll expand their policies into this country and other countries.
Oh, please, yes.
Yes.
Oh, please. Okay, let's talk about what Europe is doing in terms of making the companies take their stuff back, but the BAN.org website lists some alternatives for people. Because here I am, what if I get, you know, what? Well, ideally what I should get is brother to let me send this back to them.
And don't ask permission, just send it back.
Well, then I'm out $300 for a printer.
I
you know.
See.
Yeah. So yeah, there are some practical considerations here, but I don't know. Maybe if people are interested in starting a little consumer movement, if other people are having the same problem, maybe they can email me through the website yourownhealthandfitness.org, and we can see if there's enough people to make some trouble. But in the meantime, you list some alternatives. So can you talk about what alternatives are available for people who want to be responsible? I mean, I guess one thing we should say straight up is use your products as long as you can. I mean, we have a cell phone, which we use very rarely, that we carry turned off in, you know, when we're traveling around. That is how old now? 10, maybe 11 years old. It was the first and only cell phone that Jeffrey bought. And it works very nicely. It's fine. It only does phone calls, which is fine. It's fine. And that's it, you know. I mean, you know, I have a camera for camera. You know, I don't have to have it all. I have a computer at home for my email. I don't really want to be emailing on the road. So, you know, I've also had my computer for 7 years, I think. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I realize some people are working in industries where they have to upscale, you know, have to update and stuff. But I just would first say to people, please try to hang on to your equipment as long as you can. Don't just say, wow, that's sexy, let's have that one.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. And the best thing that we can do with this particular waste stream or product line is to use it as long as possible. It created a lot of poisons to make it. It used a lot of Earth's resources to make it. And the best thing we can do is extend its life as long as possible. So that is by far the number one option in terms of minimizing the environmental footprint of these products.
I have one other very quick question before you tell us about how to recycle better, or if it's at all possible, which is it the case that some of the companies are now, well, one company in particular is advertising that they're making a computer that's recyclable. Do you think it's true?
Yes, it is true.
I suppose we can say it. It's Apple. Yeah.
There's companies that are really working towards the most benign products that they can. ASUS is another manufacturer.
Which one?
It's spelled ASUS. It's a lesser known manufacturer. They have a
computers?
Computer with a bamboo case that's absolutely beautiful. And I don't know that it's actually fully available on the market, but many of these companies are really experimenting with this and putting out, I don't know what they call them, but sort of trial units to see how they survive.
Hmm.
And Apple was actually not doing very well on toxins about a year and a half ago, and they became the single target for this electronics take-back coalition. And since then, they have now gone to the forefront of companies that are trying to phase out the toxins. And it takes time, of course, to do the research and development to find safer alternatives, but Apple is now at the forefront of trying to do that. They were pretty horrid about a year and a half ago, I have to say.
Oh, goody, then. This very pretty iMac that I have that looks like it landed on my desk that's in the museum, you know, has an award for design, is actually a toxic monster. Let me just say, this is your own health and fitness. I'm Elena Berman with Jeff Fawcett here. And we're talking to Sarah Westervelt from BAN, Basal Action Network, BAN.org, and we're talking about e-waste. So please, I will now try to be quiet, and you tell us about some alternatives to what you can do if you actually do have to get rid of a product.
Well, when our first expose came out documenting what's happening in China, it was called Exporting Harm. Many people contacted us, everybody from individuals to municipalities and corporations, saying, yikes, we don't want our computers to end up on the riverbank with children and all sorts of horrible exposures occurring. And so how do we avoid that? How do we know what our recyclers are doing? And we had to say, we don't know. We've done research, and it looks like just about everybody is exporting, so just hang on to it. And what we did at that point, this was in 2003, was to develop a set of criteria or a standard for globally responsible recycling of electronic waste. And that's one of the things I've been doing for the last 5 years, is administering that program of trying to identify recyclers in the U.S. and Canada who actually meet this standard defined by the environmental community and which respects this United Nations treaty, unlike our federal government. And so it's really trying to find companies who are willing to go beyond compliance, beyond the current regulations. And what happened simultaneously was many people said, oh, we just need to send all of our unwanted electronics into the reuse market, and we'll bridge the digital divide. Let's send our computers to African nations and South America. And we did another expose in the fall of 2005 called The Digital Dump, which documented about 500 containers. These are the huge 40-foot shipping containers per month going into Lagos, Nigeria. So this is just one port in Africa, going in and full of electronic waste. And the Nigerians were interested in working equipment. They have no facilities, unlike China, where they're trying to break things down and extract the materials so they can turn them into new products. The African nations were only interested in finding working equipment. And so much, and what we found there, we interviewed the recyclers, the computer associations who were selling these products. They said about 75% of what was arriving was junk, just completely unusable, and they were burning mountains, literally mountains and mountains of this, both in their formal and informal landfills. So we had to have the situation where there is now, in the name of bridging the digital divide, there's all this stuff supposedly going into reuse when actually it's just ending up in yet another burning mountain in a developing country. So we've been in the process of for a number of years now trying to help the public, including corporations and municipalities, understand how to identify the best players. And we call them e-stewards, and these are companies who have gone through a vetting process with us, which has been what I would call sort of a desk audit and a paper audit, where we track their toxic materials as defined in the international treaty, not in our U.S. laws, which exempts most of the toxic materials in this waste stream. We track those toxic materials all the way to final final processing, the very end of its, you know, processing. And frequently that's in other countries. And what we're doing right now, actually, is we're transforming that, this, the current eStudents program, into an independently audited and certified program that has a whole accreditation oversight. So, in other words, we are better defining the standards. And once again, they will be standards that are held by the environmental community. They're not the result of a multi-stakeholder process where you end up with sort of the lowest common denominator. But it's a very high standard, and then it's going to be rigorously audited by independent certifying bodies who will have another accreditation body watching over their shoulder. So you have watchers watching the watchers who then come in and audit the recyclers. So that's going to be up and running in very early 2010, which, you know, is, seems like a long ways away. But meanwhile, we have these companies that are on our website called eStewards that have gone through our current vetting process, which we do ourselves. And we very much encourage people to call them, even if you don't have one in your town. If there's one in state or in the next state over, contact them and just ask them if what it would take to get material to them. And many of them will send trucks out and could do a pickup. And consumers need to expect to pay for these services. So until the manufacturers are providing free take-back like required by law in Europe, they need to expect to pay because we are getting rid of hazardous waste and we need to be responsible for that.
What occurs to me is that local garbage companies are starting to include e-waste recycling in their programs, and nobody, I don't know where they're taking this stuff, so they're likely to be taking it to one of the big e-waste recyclers who are sending them overseas. So it occurs to me that people might want to contact their local garbage companies if they're thinking of leaving a piece out for them. I did leave a piece. I feel terrible now. And sort of pressuring them into telling them who it is and doing, you know, and vetting them and seeing whether, you know, maybe getting back to the garbage company and saying, hey, no, don't do this. The other thing is that it might be, from what you're saying, because it sounds like there may be some progress, that it might be good for people to hang on to their products for a year or two more, sort of store them somewhere safe, wrap them in plastic, and just wait. Old plastic, recycled plastic. No new plastic. But anyway, hold on to them because it sounds like some of this stuff is going to change over the next year or two.
Let me respond to your second comment first. And I would not suggest that people hang on to their products. If you do have to get rid of something, if you can't upgrade it and use it longer, it is actually better to find a very responsible refurbisher and try to send that product into a legitimate reuse market now while it still has some, it's not completely obsolete. It still has some sort of technological life left in it. And many of the companies on our list, the eStewards list at BAN.org, are indeed refurbishers or asset recovery companies. And so they are doing very good job of wiping the data and upgrading and testing everything to make sure it's fully functional, replacing dead mercury lamps behind your LCD screen or the bad circuit board, all of which are hazardous waste or a bad battery. And then many times it is going to a developing country, and of course eventually that will become hazardous waste in that developing country. But right now the international treaty, this Basel Convention, doesn't cover tested working products that are truly going to reuse. So I would recommend that people don't hang on to everything, but rather find a refurbisher who's going to do the testing and refurbishing in-house, in other words, in their facility, and they'll only sell something that's working.
Mm-hmm.
On the earlier comment you said about the curb, basically the garbage services picking up this material, I'm very skeptical that any curbside pickup program is going to be doing the right thing. And the reason for that is that states have no jurisdiction over export. In other words, if a municipality signs a contract with a company to do curbside pickup and come and bring your electronics, pick up your electronics at your house, those municipalities or states have no authority to write into that contract, you must not send hazardous waste to China or any of the developing countries. They don't have the authority to do that. It's a federal authority to control exports. And of course, many of these municipalities are trying to provide free recycling for everybody. They don't want to put up a disincentive and for people to recycle, so they want to make it free. And really, the only way to do this free is to export it. So I would encourage people not to put their electronics at the curb. And another reason for that, too, is that once it gets wet, I live in Seattle, of course, so it's highly likely it will get wet up here. But once it gets rained on, much of it is not going to be reusable. So you've got a couple of good reasons why you shouldn't end up putting this stuff by the curb.
Something else I'm hearing is that you just mentioned the LED screens.
LCDs.
I keep doing this backwards. LED is lights, and I was thinking, don't say the light ones, say the LCD screens, thank you, that they have mercury in them, and I would assume that the large television screens and the plasma screens, the big screen TVs, that you gorgeous things that you hang on the wall, oh, I wish I could have one. I won't buy one now because you just said what you said. I figure I should stick with the toxic Sony Trinitron that we have instead of buying some new toxic thing.
Well, the LCD screens, liquid crystal display screens, which most of our laptops have, do have mercury fluorescent lamps backlighting them. So right behind the screen are sometimes as many as 14 tiny little fluorescent lamps, these long bulbs. And that mercury in those computers and laptops and other things are basically exempt from our U.S. definitions of hazardous waste. And so what recyclers are doing, some of them are doing in this country, is they're throwing those, the broken ones, into shredders in their warehouses and shredding this mercury, which, of course, vaporizes, and then you've got a direct worker exposure. Some of it vaporizes, some of it goes into the shredded material, and so now you've dispersed a very toxic material into a much larger volume waste, which it then goes to a smelter. The smelters don't want mercury. And so these LCD screens, even though they don't have the huge quantities of lead that we've got in our old cathode ray tubes, the old heavy TVs and monitors, the glass ones, they do have the mercury in them. Yeah. And in addition to mercury, there's all the circuit boards. Many of the circuit boards tend to have lead solder and arsenic even, and the brominated flame retardants and some of the phthalates. So we are really looking at very toxic products here.
Yeah, we should be following Cuba's example and just keep fixing things and use them. We are very much running out of time, but I want to remind people that you can go to www.ban.org and you will find lists of all kinds of things that you want in articles. We've been talking with Sarah Westervelt from BAN, Basel Action Network, again, the BAN.org, and I want to thank you so much. You've just been an amazing guest. Thank you so much for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for doing the show, Elena.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.
And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, how to get CD copies and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett, PhD. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.